Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also would like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service, NIRS. And also, if you're listening via our website or our app at 989fm.com.au, beaming us around the continent and into your beautiful communities. My guest on the program this morning is Rouge from Victoria. Rouge is a part of Get Up. If you would have heard the program last week, I had a chat with Bunjalung woman Larissa Baldwin about her role, her new role with Get Up. Just before we start, Rouge, could I get you to tell us a bit about yourself and also your role at Get Up?
Thanks so much for having me. My name is Rouge Ahmedi. I'm the Senior Racial Justice and Human Rights Campaigner at Get Up, and I help run Colour Code, which is a platform to advocate and fight for racial justice in this country, and it's for communities of colour and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And I work with a great team of people from migrant backgrounds and also with Larissa Baldwin. My background is varied. So I originally came to Australia as a refugee. I'm a Kurdish woman from Iraq, and I come from a long line of family who were very politically active and activists in the country. And because of that activism and also because of our ethnic minority status, we were rendered stateless, and a lot of us were punished for our political activism. So that's my family history, and I think that feeds into all my advocacy and activism and community building work up to this role. And I always, I never really thought that I would get into a career or a job in activism, which is, you know, what my role is at Get Up. I always thought that activism was just a part of being in a community and benefiting from settler colonialism and, you know, wanting to give back. And so whether it was LGBT rights or gender rights, racial justice, refugee rights, you know, trying to be an accomplice to Aboriginal justice movements here on Wurundjeri land, it was just something that I just saw was my responsibility alongside, you know, my past history and working in publishing and media and public policy.
Deadly. Thanks for that. One thing that I did ask Larissa last week, you know, she comes from, working with, I guess, in an all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander space from seed. And then, you know, coming to Get Up, I guess, which, you know, I hope it's all right for me to say, is like a majority, you know, I guess, sort of white organization, even though it's somewhat left as well. It's seen as, you know, like a big NGO type sort of organization with a million members. Like, you wouldn't sort of think that, you know, such a large network of a group like Get Up would sort of be open, you know, to First Nations rights, to refugee rights, to the rights of, you know, queer and trans communities as well. I guess when you first, you know, started working here, or before you heard about Get Up, did you sort of have these, I guess, reservations sort of about this organization?
Yeah, I've always had reservations about the non-governmental organisations or non-for-profits like Get Up. And I've been quite critical about their strategy and the way that often they express social justice issues with a race-blind perspective. So they're not really acknowledging that if we're talking about economic justice, they need to acknowledge that the people hurt most by policies are often Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And then you've got migrant communities and refugee communities. Or if you're talking about, you know, democracy and access to your rights and your votes, and oftentimes being incarcerated removes that agency as a person in this country. And who is often incarcerated? It's often like Black people. So I think that is an issue, and I think that I've always seen human rights movements in Australia to be like quite white. Mm-hmm. And by dominant communities, and I've been highly critical of that. But I also, when I did a lot of refugee advocacy work, and I worked with a lot of the refugee sector as a consultant or on an advisory level, I actually found that the human rights team at GetUp had really sound politics, but also knew that they needed to take the 10 to 15 steps to achieve the end goal, and that you need to take people on that journey. And I guess, like, the pervasive nature of whiteness in Australia even permeates in, like, somewhat progressive spaces because we actually haven't really come to terms with much of our history. And by we, I mean, like, settlers. And that, I think, influences the way that we conduct, you know, activism and campaigns and stuff. But in all credit to GetUp, and something that I wouldn't see in most other non-for-profits, is that they're able to somewhat acknowledge this and try and make the necessary steps. And obviously it's a messy process, but considering, you know, the context that they work in, they've done quite a lot in comparison to other other organizations, and, you know, and they're willing to take those steps and do that messy business of shifting that and changing that and handing, you know, like handing a permanent position to someone like me who comes from more like grassroots community building. I very much have been focused on, you know, for us, by us, campaigning and advocacy, and have been very abolitionist minded and stuff. So to actually give me the capacity and the tools and the platform to make change is, I think, an acknowledgement and obviously a very basic one, and we've got a long way to go, but I'm excited to see what we can achieve, or we can like shift and change the diversity of like the makeup of all of our members.
And if you're just tuning in to Let's Talk, my guest on the program this morning is Rouge Amidi. And we're going to head to a quick song break. And this song we're going to head to is called Is This What We Deserve by Uncle Kutcha Edwards, who's also from down that way, down in Victoria. This is a great song that talks about Is This What We Deserve. And, you know, that pretty much says the gist of the song. And I think it goes well with our conversation.
Is this what we deserve? Is this what we deserve? Is this what we deserve? All I'm asking, Lord, is this what we deserve? We've been here since time began. Our ancestors' footprints are buried in the sand. We are but caretakers of this ancient land. But you still don't understand. Is this what we deserve? Is this what we deserve? wars are so unjustified. Our basic human rights have been denied. Come up with excuses like your hands are tied. But you go on committing genocide. Is this what we deserve? Is this what we deserve? Is this what we deserve? Can you tell me now? Is this what we deserve? Just keep on trying. And our poor eyes, they just keep on crying. And sadly, our people, they just keep on dying. While you just keep on lying. Is this what we deserve? Is this what we deserve? Is this what we deserve? Can you tell me now? Is this what we deserve?
This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
And you're back on Let's Talk. I'm your host, Bo Spearham. That was Uncle Kutcher Edwards with Is This What We Deserve? And my guest on the program this morning is Rouge. We've been yarning for quite a bit now about her role at Get Up. Just back on what you were saying there and also Colour Code, you know, I guess now that you're sort of working with Get Up and in this space, you know, because it tends to be quite easy to sort of separate, you know, Aboriginal issues, refugee issues, sorry, and other issues, you know, real minority issues within, you know, Australia as well. And especially when you're sort of put in a position to advocate, you know, for, I guess, the majority of minority groups as well. You know, I guess now you're in the position to sort of be in a blanket sort of position where you're surrounded by other activists and other campaigners as well. How important is it to sort of be within that framework, have that support, but then also be in that position to sort of advocate, I guess, at a higher level to a broader sort of community as well?
I think it's challenging and it's really exciting at the same time, because I understand that, like, when you are campaigning, you often need to take like multiple steps to take people on a journey of understanding, and you also have to meet people where they are, and you have to make your language accessible. And that's a really exciting part for me, because I think that oftentimes, if you know a lot of like new and emerging activists, and not like people on the front line of like This is kind of my reference to like young people of color in this country who are from like migrant backgrounds or refugee backgrounds and things like that. And oftentimes, they the people who have most prominence or platforms are people who are well versed in race theory. They oftentimes are university educated. They have access to the internet and other tools, and so they can get kind of caught up with the theory and not really talk about how to put it into practice. Mm. And putting that theory is very difficult, and like to not acknowledge that, I think, is to the detriment of like how you're trying to be inclusive. And I think that I think that's a really important lesson to learn, and something that I knew, but I'm putting more into practice because I have to be way more inclusive to like communities that are often more privileged, mm-hmm. and need to get them on board, but also not undermine or minimize the experiences and the expertise that people with lived experience are bringing to an issue. And so it's a kind of a delicate balance, because you need a lot of you need people to like get behind your movement, and you need to communicate to them in a clear way. And oftentimes I'm discussing really, really complex issues, and oftentimes people like in the public want a really clear like enemy, and they want a figure that is an enemy, but it's really difficult to translate that kind of narrative, that desire for like a key figure or like a hateful figure, and try and explain to people that something is systemic and systematic and it's structural. And so, like, you have to tell stories. It's about telling stories and, like, bringing, you know, a single narrative that exemplifies or, like, really captures the structural stuff. And then you start to kind of chip away into people's, like, knowledge of like, the actual underlying issue. But, you know, people are often working and they have caregiving roles and they're looking after their community and they have very little time to actually understand these complex things. So it's like a really big challenge to, you know, be weighing up so many contrasting issues and try and not do harm, but also people's lived experience, and then also make it accessible for the everyday person who may have like conflicting, you know, responsibilities. So I think that's definitely been a huge challenge, and definitely an even bigger one in my role.
Definitely, you know, because I guess as an Aboriginal person, like, we don't sort of tend to see, I guess, the position that like refugee and migrant communities are put into, sort of put into this, I guess, you know, if I could say, you know, in a position to sort of assimilate into white Australia, but then also having this conflict, you know, of identity, you know, coming from, you know, a war-torn place, which, you know, majority of the time Australia has their hands involved in as well. You know, and then sort of coming, you know, finding, you know, a different sort of environment to live in, but then also, you know, at the same time, not necessarily knowing that sort of underlying sort of history between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and also their own lived experience as well, you know. And I think, like, we mentioned it just before as well on how good, you know, I don't like to, you know, give them any credit, but how good they tend to keep our communities segregated or broken up, and, you know, sort of dump us all in this, you know.
And that's the intention, like, that is a very clear intention, and that's something that I'm trying to combat with Colour Code. And because I think the pervasive nature of like colonization in this country perpetuates like other really harmful things like the model minority concept where you just got to like keep your head down, work hard, keep your mouth shut, and then you'll get ahead, which like is never true. And I think that, you know, balancing that thing of even like I had to come to terms with it where you become displaced because of colonization and then you benefit because of colonization, and to actually like come to terms with those, that conflicting reality, and to, you know, like sit in it and like accept it and live in it, and then think about what you can do in those circumstances. And I think that, you know, like there's, I would love to see, you know, like there's the greatest fear, I think, of like whiteness in this country is like if we were to unite and if we were to have like movements of solidarity and if we actually started to, you know, fight for our rights and then fight for justice and then fight for liberation. And I always see it as those kind of three steps where we, you know, it's a long-term thing and, you know, and it's going to take a long time to build, but there have been like historical examples of it. And, you know, it's like good to take inspiration and take off from there. But yeah, it's definitely like, I think they're just like terrified. And I think the perfect example of that is like how the culture wars have been really amped up in particular in the last like year and a half. To 3 years, because suddenly you're seeing even like the discussion of like one issue like Invasion Day growing and people talking about it and people turning up to like, especially like down here in like where, you know, people like there's refugee organizations and there's like communities of color and stuff like wanting to show up to those things and have those conversations and trying to like dismantle, you know, something that they've been like socialized in, where they have like completely erased in their mind like the concept of Aboriginal sovereignty and autonomy and stuff. But they're like trying to like have the beginnings of that new conversation, and it's really, I think, really scary for like the colonial construct.
Oh, definitely. Like we saw it earlier this week when Pauline Hanson pushed the motion to it's okay to be white, and you know, all these, you know, senators sort of put their hand up and supported. Even Nigel Scully, you know, the who holds the portfolio of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, definitely they're scared, you know, and like I guess that's why, you know, they always try to push that, you know, continue to push that negative spin on whether it's migrant communities, whether it's African communities down in Victoria, whether it's, you know, the violent nature of these Invasion Day protests or the Stolenworth Games protest. But then also it's a different narrative when, you know, they talk about these like white supremacist groups, you know, like the UPF, like which I didn't really want to mention, but, you know, like these other groups that, you know, continue to sort of push that narrative of, you know, white is right and or white and white is right, and the big look at you know, keeping sort of this tradition of this like white patriarchal culture.
Yeah, I think like also Pauline Hanson, just due to like the changes to the Senate voting system, doesn't need to talk to anyone else except for that very like extreme group. And although like a large proportion of the Australian community have had like very open tendencies to be racist, that specific group, like she is using that, harnessing it, feeding into it because it kind of feeds into her like power. And But and what's worse though is that the way I think about it, a couple months ago, I was in Europe and I was talking to a broad range of organizations trying to combat neo-Nazi groups across like Eastern Europe, countries like Austria and Germany and stuff. And we were talking about how do we combat this, and one thing is that a lot of these countries have had neo-Nazi groups enter into their, you know, parliaments or their spaces of like power in their countries. But for us, we've had these groups like permeate through, establish, you know, somewhat mainstream parties. And that's the terrifying thing, is that the speed in which these kind of extreme forms of white supremacy, not just like the normal mainstream forms, but extreme forms, have been able to like step into these parties, but also feed into their fear and have like ministers of parliament dog whistle and all very clearly indicate to these groups is terrifying, and actually like is an acknowledgement of how these groups so quickly grow in Australia. And there was, you know, and but they also grow in not the similar way that you see in other countries where they're, you know, doing giant marches, but they're growing digitally. And that's the kind of terrifying thing, because you don't see that physical space. You actually have like digital tools that are kind of spreading this dangerous thing. But it's also not like the notion of like an increase of these parties doesn't really acknowledge the fact that we have an underlying issue in this country as well. And so I don't want to take away from that, like these identifiable neo-Nazi groups can't negate or like make us erase the fact that we are very much susceptible to those things in this country.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Did, I guess, like in your travels, you know, overseas, do people sort of mention this sort of racist history and these racist policies that Australia continues to have, whether it's Northern Territory intervention, whether it's, you know, the CDEP sort of program style slave wage, or also like the history of, you know, detention centers in Australia? Is that sort of, other than, you know, like the rise of the far right, is there sort of still this knowledge of how, you know, insidious, I guess you could say, that Australia has been and continues to be?
Yeah, I think that we have a international reputation for those things, and how we have quashed First Nations justice movements, and we also like have and we have like a long history of incarceration, like and imprisonment. And the terrifying thing, though, is that our concepts of incarceration and imprisonment, the way I see it is that our imprisonment of refugees is very similar to, like, imprisonment of, like, Aboriginal people. And that's where the inspiration has come from. But it's, like, terrifying to see that our systems of, like, imprisoning people who seek safety or imprisoning people who have been displaced by colonization on this land and stuff is like a source of inspiration for a lot of countries now. And I
for
think,
the fact that they just don't look black. I mean, sorry, and for the fact that they don't just look white.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's this great fear. I think, like, the perfect example of that is last year when the offshore detention center on Manus Island was shut down and the government was just trying to wash their hands from that responsibility. The men on that island have a incredible system of democracy and leadership and self-advocacy. Like, they have been absolutely, like, they've been, you know, on the front lines of the fight. And they, you know, led some like protests and also like created systems of like water catchment and helping each other out and, you know, healthcare when there was no healthcare and no access to medicine and things like that. But the response from the public was to see it as a negative thing, and that actually support for people who were seeking safety and who had been detained by the Australian government suddenly dropped, because we don't want to see like brown and black people have agency or advocate for themselves. And there is this kind of discomfort with that. And I think that we need to really interrogate those ideas and, yeah, and really like question why, you know, the mainstream is so uncomfortable with that, and why we feel so then comfortable to imprison people and indefinitely in a lot of in these cases.
And if you're just tuning in to Let's Talk, my guest on the program is Ruj Amidi, and she's from GetUp. She works in a campaign called Colour Code, which works with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities and also refugee and migrant communities about bridging that gap in between. I guess like one of the things we were conversating about is there's sort of this gap between both communities. And I think it's a deliberate gap because nobody wants to see the rise of black and brown migrant and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. It's something white people fear. And I guess that's something that Pauline Hanson wanted to make sure she sort of holds a tight grip on with her vote in the Senate. It's okay to be white. We're going to take another song break, and we're going to head to Uncle Archie Roach with A Beautiful Child.
Oh, my beautiful child, my beautiful child, the brightest of stars, couldn't match your sweet smile, but you grew up too soon, far beyond your young years. Now all that remains is your memory and tears. You were always to blame, but you weren't really bad, just a little bit wild. Now they'll hound you no more. Oh, my beautiful child, beautiful, beautiful child, now you are free. From this heartache and pain and misery, when they found your body that day, some said you smiled, and I wish I was with you right now, my beautiful child. You'd been locked up before, but you always came back with your head held high and so proud to be black. But the last time they came, how could I have known when they took you away that you'd never come home? They pushed you around, 'cause your skin wasn't white, and although you were gentle, you learned how to fight, and you fought all your life. No, you didn't fail, but you did.
deserve better than to die in some jail.
That was Uncle Arch Roach with A Beautiful Child. Everybody was really, really banking on the fact that Peter Dutton doesn't get in, you know, because of the obvious reasons, but sort of slip through the cracks. You know, Scott Morrison, who has, you know, as much of a more history with the ill treatment of refugees, having the highest number of children incarcerated in these offshore prisons. You know, also behind the writing of Border Force and all these other things as well. Yeah, I just wanted you to get your comment about that sort of PM spill and how everybody was sort of rushing to sort of keep Peter Dutton out. And then out of nowhere, you know, Scott Morrison sort of steps in the job.
Yeah, I think that Peter Dutton is a huge threat because he has been able to achieve something that no other minister with his portfolios have been achieved, which is to unite all the law enforcement bodies and agencies under one roof and then allow for, like, his ministry to, like, run in this weird, opaque way where there's no transparency and there's no checks and balances, and then he's just got too many discretionary powers. I think last time I checked, it was about 67 discretionary powers that he can just make on his own without any review. And I think that that is really harmful because it, like, militarized immigration and militarized a lot of, like, quite benign kind of bureaucratic processes. But also Scott Morrison is also an equal danger because he has dog whistled to the same divisive, hateful politics. He has introduced so many policies that harm the poorest, the most disenfranchised, oftentimes like migrant communities, and he's willing to throw communities under the bus for his own political gain. And so I think that, it's, like I said before, it's easy to, like, hate a villain, but it's more difficult to understand that the underlying system or a party or an organization is the harmful thing. It feeds into, it feeds into the harm that we've been seeing, the way that, like, our rights are being diminished and destroyed. More people are living, you know, in poor health, lacking access to education and safe water and being able to have free movement and autonomy, all those things. So I think that, like, that shift, or, like, being able to communicate to people that, you know, it doesn't have to be a singular figure or a singular villain, but it's also about the larger system and a larger, like, you know, the party that holds these views and defends these views and perpetuates, you know, a lot of policies that harm people. But I think, you know, we try to communicate that and get up and try and explain that, you know, whether you have Dutton or Morrison, there's going to be a lot of harm being done to communities that have, like, seen it tough, while at the same time, their mates in corporations have been having, like, huge kickbacks and being able to, you know, like, fake foundations that are purport to like support the Great Barrier Reef get like half a million dollars and, you know, things like that, that, you know, that you constantly see, and yet we, and then we, our communities get constantly blamed for the hard times and that we have to suffer and we have to experience these austerity measures and stuff. And then, so it's a, it's like a, you know, it's a perfect example of like trying to explain that there's an underlying issue and we need to combat it structurally. But that's not like, when you actually tell people we need to combat it structurally, and that it's actually like a broader, more entrenched issue, and that we need to not only stop whatever like destruction of our rights is happening or whatever policies that are going to harm a lot of people and be insightful to that, but we have to like look at the underlying issues that have led to that point. And that's the balance, and that's a careful balance that I think a lot of like campaigners and activists like myself have to constantly be aware of and keep our ear to the ground.
Definitely, because it's about painting sort of that narrative or making that understanding where sort of community level people who sort of are out of those positions that, or, you know, not attached to the, I guess, the position that you're in, that don't necessarily understand. How do you, how do you sort of create a campaign of solidarity, whether it's with refugees or Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people in the midst of, you know, like these far right groups? Like, you did mention it before, how you said you went to Europe, you visited, you know, you spoke about various different places where they're sort of, there's a high attack on sort of their political institutions as well. Because like when we talk about racism as well, it's a top down sort of approach to it, you know, because there are, like you said, there are sort of these structural systems that are in place to sort of keep it in. So like when we sort of try and attack or like combat, you know, certain structures of racism or individuals, like you said, you know, like how do you paint that picture for community people, you know, in terms of sort of having a structural sort of view at racism?
I think that sometimes like people want you to like, the way I see it is that my role is part of an ecosystem. And so you can't like, my job right now is to combat like the electoral and policy level fight. So I'm trying to like get community and build community and build a movement to combat the very like direct, clear things that are happening right now. So for example, if we're talking about migrant rights, the government has promoted and highlighted and flagged that they will introduce policies that will introduce a university level English language test to become a citizen, a general English language test to become a permanent resident. They'll prevent migrants from accessing social services like, you know, family benefits and welfare and things like that. They're kind of like slowly weakening or like minimizing or making smaller the funnel of who can actually be a member of the society and be an equal member of the society. And they're also going to like try and encode that and put it into a system and automate that process by privatizing the entire like migration and visa system, which means that a computer will decide if you are allowed to stay in this country. And it actually, just like codifies particular types of people from particular communities and denies them access to, you know, access to fair and equal rights. Which like you see that system and that treatment of like particular types of migrants, and they've introduced like pretty much similar systems for the last 230 years for sovereign people. So they've taken inspiration, they've implemented those policies, and now they're going to expand it. And it's pretty much like what I would see as like the reincarnation of the White Australia policy in terms of a migration system. And they introduced punitive measures for people seeking safety, and they've incarcerated people who are seeking safety, but they've also started incarcerating people who are migrants who may have overstayed their visa and who are seen desirable or unwelcome and from particular countries that they deem unfavorable. And so you see that systemic thing, and you see those kind of policy changes. So my role is to like get people together and see the bigger picture of that. It's like part of a very well-intentioned campaign and campaign towards that. But I also want people to come on that journey knowing that this is nothing new and that we need to be united in and celebrate in our diversity and know our history and be empowered by that knowledge and like go on that journey. So not only are we like fighting for our own rights, but we start to like collaborate and unify and start to understand that there is like a deeper issue, and we can lead the way in terms of having that honest conversation. Because up to this point, I feel like a lot of these movements have been led by people without lived experience and led by like people who don't come from like migrant backgrounds, who are not white. And it's really important to shift that and really center the people who are experiencing it. And I think that the thing that excites me the most is that I'm part of that ecosystem and I'm part of that broader picture. And although I can't achieve it all, it's really exciting to be at the forefront of that and then take people on that, in that conversation.
I've just got two more questions and then we'll wrap it up. It's funny, like, this is sort of a statement. It's funny, like, Australia sort of has, you know, these really strict immigration laws. We take in the least amount of refugees, I believe, than most sort of countries that take in refugees. How bad of the tightening of refugee rights? You know, like, what are their rights and, like, I guess, what do they miss out on? Early this year, actually, sadly, you know, like there was a refugee brother that lost his life in Logan City, just south of Brisbane, about half an hour from where I am at the moment. You know, took his own life because he was threatened. He was on his way being detained and sent back to a refugee camp and then sent back to his country. What are sort of those rights that refugees hold? I guess to get basic health care and all this stuff as well. And then how could listeners sort of follow the work or get involved in the deadly work that yourself, Larissa, and other people are doing at GetUp?
Not only are people in really, really, really unstable situations and they're being detained, but there's also like a really complex web of temporary visas that people are granted that prevent them from like accessing basic social services like healthcare and like counseling, things like that. But they also they've been denied, you know, that autonomy and that kind of like this constant fear. And like I said, like the immigration system is now so opaque and complex that it's really difficult to navigate, especially if you don't speak English, especially if you fear being deported, if you fear having your visa cancelled. You know, there's been also like another thing that I didn't mention before as part of this kind of like punishing punitive migration system is that there's been a very long campaign to deport people and cancel the visas of people who may have been who may have done their time in prison, but now they're getting punished the second time and getting deported as well. And a lot of these people are being deported back to countries that they don't have a connection to anymore, or they may have been born there and then had grown up in Australia and had like had lived their entire life here, and only now are being deported because there's this kind of weird like character assessment that's been happening that is like undermining like fair and just access to the law. So there's those elements as well, this constant fear that like whatever stability that you have access right now could be gone in an instant. And what we know about human nature is that when you put people in a position where there's scarcity to health and security and and safety and access to your family and community and being able to like move freely. If you remove all of those things, you actually prevent people from actually thinking into their future and wanting to build something for their future and having like a sense of self-worth. And so it's very like psychologically damaging. And so and there's been like huge cuts to access to the SSRS, which is pretty much social services such as basic welfare. Sorry, I've just got to wait for this giant truck to say that again. There's been a cut to the SSRS, which is a system to provide newly immigrated refugees access to social services and counseling and trauma counseling. And, you know, those kind of basic things that help them have some sense of stability during a time which is, like, quite unstable and very like scary. And so that's been removed for a large portion of newly arrived refugees. And so we hear stories of people being out on the streets and having no other option because they don't have community and they don't have like family here and they can't speak the language. And you know, some of them haven't been like, you know, haven't had access to education, so they're not quite sure how to navigate this. So I think like fighting for those people like comes with supporting campaigns that stop those changes, which is like something that we do. So currently we're running the Kids Off Nauru campaign, which is trying to evacuate the kids and their families off Nauru who've been living there indefinitely for 5 years. So it's about supporting it on the front line of the campaign, but also supporting people on a day-to-day. And I think that there are lots of organizations that are giving access to healthcare and support services. But the issue is that these organizations are non-for-profits and they are feeding into the destitution of these people in some way because the government has released their responsibility to these people. But it is the government's job to provide that safety and security and all those kind of basic services that allow a person to like live. And the issue has been is that they've transferred that responsibility into, you know, NGOs and non-for-profits. But it's really important for us to advocate that they take that back and they make that system clearer, more safe, more accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. But as a stopgap solution, there are lots of organizations that are providing those services. One of them is Rise in NAM, and they are a refugee-led organization that has their food bank and things like that. But we also like campaign on refugee rights and combating the detention system and trying to like dismantle it and bring people to safety and highlight the fact that that, you know, it's unfair and the system should not exist. But in my job as well, I'm taking a broader lens and examining the fact that this is the punishing process and system that we see that has been like focused on refugees is now becoming part of the broader, you know, migration system, and it's hurting people from refugees to migrants. It's like anyone who is from a country that's not a Western country and who's not white is going to be harmed, and it's like we need to combat that from the get-go before it gets any worse, but also articulate what does it look like to have something that's like more just and more equitable.
Definitely. I just want to say a big thanks for joining us on the program this morning. If you're ever in Brisbane, I would love to have you in the studio live, or you know, do whatever, give you a tour of the station as well. Doing some great work down there in like whether or not you're in Queensland, but would love to have you on the program again to talk about this stuff, and also get a bit more in depth as well and broad about life in one of these detention centres these offshore prisons that, you know, some refugee mob are experiencing. But no, big thank you for joining us on the program this morning. Also for our listeners, there was a bit of a time sort of mix up by myself, so we had to sort of fix that up as well. But so big thanks for that as well.
Yeah, thanks so much, and thanks for having me. And I'd love to be in the studio next time I'm in Brizzy.
Definitely, definitely. Thanks, Ed. If you're just tuning in, my guest on the program was Ruj Amedi. Did I pronounce that right?
Amedi, yeah.
Amedi, sorry. Yeah. From Get Up, does deadly work on the ground, working with community, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people, and also refugee and migrant communities down there in Nam. Thanks for joining us on the program. Just remember, you can listen to the podcast at 989fm.com.au, or you could tune into 989fm to catch the repeat at 7 p.m. You have been listening to Let's Talk here on 989fm.